Hola. That concludes the Spanish language portion of my presentation. I'm Neil Humphrey, as Pat said, and I'm an education researcher at the University of Manchester in the UK. I'd first of all like to thank our hosts for the weather, which has made me feel at home. Coming from Manchester, this is every day. I'd also like to apologise. If I'd known I was going to be on camera, I would have shaved, worn a tie, been slightly more smartly dressed. Okay, so I'm going to talk through some of the social challenges and opportunities surrounding the development of biomarkers for autism and build on some of the things that Pat mentioned in her talk. So as I said, my background is as an education psychology researcher, and so this whole field of biomarkers is something very new to me. And as a result, the discussion that I'm going to present will come perhaps as a kind of a naive viewpoint, if you like, or a lay viewpoint. The objectives of my talk are to identify and discuss the implications of autism biomarker research for the difference, disability and disorder debate. So this idea around the words which we use to describe individuals on the autism spectrum. All the autism spectrums, as we heard this morning from Christopher. And to consider possible wider tensions, challenges, and opportunities of this research in relation to issues of identity, which Pat had mentioned, and inclusion, both in education and in society for individuals on the autism spectrum. So, difference, disability, and disorder. I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that most of the people in this room are used to using the word disorder as opposed to disability or difference when describing individuals on the autism spectrum. Now, that may be wrong, but this brings across something that is being paid increased attention to in the research and in the literature in this area. The key issue around this debate is that the words that we use to describe individuals with autism carry implicit values and assumptions. Now, the first thing to say is that these different words don't necessarily denote any malicious or ill intent on the part of the person conveying them, but it's the way in which they can be interpreted and the way in which they can be understood which sometimes causes them to be controversial. So when we use the term disorder, which appears in DSM-5 and in all the previous manuals. What do we mean when we talk about disorder? Well, first of all, if you speak to some individuals from the autism community, they find it very objectionable. There's a young man called Luke Jackson who's quite well known in the UK. I don't know if he's well known outside of the UK, but he's a young man with Asperger syndrome who has written several books now and is a very kind of active member of the autism community and thinks the word disorder is actually, you know, quite problematic, partly because when it's used to describe him, he thinks of himself as one of the most orderly persons that he knows. So it implies a problem, it implies ill health, it implies pathology, and importantly, it implies deficit within the individual. So it's talking about a problem located within the individual, somebody who deviates from the norm, and again, thinking back to Pat's presentation, the distinction where we draw the line between what we think is normal, acceptable behaviour and what we think is disordered or maladaptive behaviour. And it derives directly from a medical view of autism. So this idea that there is a disease state within the individual which we research the causes of and which we research ways of reducing the disease state. An alternative perspective is the disability view. So viewing autism as a disability. The difference here is the disability viewpoint acknowledges the reality of impairment. So it acknowledges the reality that there are elements of autism which are extremely impairing and extremely disabling to the individuals affected and their families. But importantly, what disability advocates do is they focus more on the disabling aspects of society. So they focus more on What is it about the environment that we place individuals in, whether that's in the school or at home or in society more generally, that actually create disabling conditions? And the work that we've done at Manchester, focusing on education and particularly focusing on inclusion in mainstream schools for children on the autism spectrum, brings that into focus. So one of the things that we've been doing is looking at ways in which the school environment can be changed. So rather than expecting the individual to change, that we look at how we can change the environment to make it more autism friendly. And those people that are used to going into schools that very successfully cater for children and young people on the autism spectrum will recognise that one of the key elements that unites these very effective schools is, first of all, that they don't focus on the deficits within the child, but that they focus on changing the environment, that they focus on adapting the environment so that it better meets the needs of the young people. There's a quote from a book, Simon Baron Cohen's book called The Essential Difference, which people may have read, which is about males, females and the autistic brain. But it's a quote from a young person with Asperger's syndrome who very ably sums up this issue by saying, people with autism are like freshwater fish that are forced to live in a saltwater environment. If you change the environment, then we can thrive. And this is this summarises the disability viewpoint. So this is a social model of disability. The final component I want to talk about in this debate is the idea of autism, not as a disability necessarily or as a disorder, but autism as a difference. And again, that links directly to what Pat was saying earlier. This might be seen as a more neutral way of describing people on the autism spectrum. And the key element here is that autism is a normal human variation. So this is consistent. We've been talking about an autism spectrum or autism spectrums for many, many years. But what we don't necessarily recognise is that, you know, in order to think about a spectrum of human variation, we need to be using more neutral terms. So it rejects the classification of normal and abnormal functioning and rejects the idea that we should impose onto individuals the idea that they have some kind of deficit because the way in which they think and the way in which they behave doesn't conform to what our society feels is normal or adaptive or acceptable. So the words we use to describe individuals with autism carry these values and assumptions, whether or not we think about them when we use them or not. And it's very easy to become embroiled in whatever is the kind of fashionable or the trending terminology at the time. So immediately, if you go and look at the work that I've published, you'll see that up until the last year or two, almost every paper that I've published has used ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder, because that's the prevalent terminology used. And I've actually even had, in the last couple of years, when I've submitted papers where I use different descriptions, editorial and reviewer comments saying, that's not the terminology we use. We use the terminology disorder, and if you want this paper published, you're going to have to conform to the way in which we describe autism. So there are tensions there. So there are strengths and limitations in the application of each of these terms, and I don't want to necessarily advocate and say we should be talking about difference, we should be talking about disability, we should be talking about disorder. There isn't one winner, if you like. One of the key problems that's been raised with that final one, that issue of autism as a difference, is that it's advocated by a particular section of the autism community. And one of the objections to that is that it's a relatively small number of individuals who claim to be speaking for the entire autism community. And there are a lot of parents of children with very severely disabled children with autism and other difficulties who object to being kind of characterised in this way and actually feel that it's detrimental to the very serious disabling elements of autism. So the disability and the difference perspectives are most closely associated with the emerging voice of the autism community. And one of the things that that's enabled is to enable them to talk back to the orthodoxies in these dominant discourses that position them as disordered, deficient and dysfunctional. That's a quote from Connor talking about the idea of the way in which we describe individuals with autism as affecting their sense of identity. So they object to being described as disordered and deficient. And it's not just a semantic debate. I went to an excellent presentation at the Autism Research Conference in London in November, a keynote by Simon Baron Cohen, who talked us through the neurobiology of autism, or key elements of the neurobiology of autism. And one of the key things that came through from Simon Baron Cohen's presentation was that the neurobiology of autism demonstrates difference and not dysfunction. So where we see the neurobiological evidence around individuals with autism and unaffected individuals, it's neurobiological difference rather than dysfunction. So the brain operates differently, and again it comes back to that idea of being wired differently, rather than it being something necessarily dysfunctional per se in the way in which autistic brains are put together. And the debate around the discourse of autism has influenced our terminology. So, for example, we've seen the emerging use of autism spectrum condition as opposed to autism spectrum disorder, even in the last year or two. So if you look through the literatures in the key autism journals and more broadly in disability and special education journals, the use of the word autism spectrum condition is now being much more widely used. Or also, as I've done, descriptions of individuals on the autism spectrum as opposed to the use of the word disorder. And we've also seen the introduction of the notion of neurodiversity. So again, thinking about the human brain and the way in which there is variation in structure and in function, and that the elements of the autism community have taken that as a way of thinking about themselves as different rather than disordered. Okay. So what are some of the implications then of biomarker research? So as I said, this is not my field, so this is a very lay viewpoint, but it's a viewpoint taken from having worked in schools with children and young people on the autism spectrum and their families and teachers and so on over the last 10 or 12 years. So first of all, I'm going to quote Pat from her excellent paper in Nature Reviews Neuroscience a couple of years ago. The prospect of autism biomarkers sharpens the fundamental question of what value to place on autism as a condition. So we've heard about prevention and we've heard about issues around elective termination. And we hear quite often in the discourse, in the academic literature and in the popular literature, the notion of cure. But one of the problems inherent in that, and this is kind of where we link to biomarker research as a means of prevention and a means of cure, is that autism brings a profile of strengths and difficulties. We tend to focus on the difficulties. We tend to focus on the very disabling elements of autism. But we also, as Pat said, need to recognise some of the considerable strengths. And the argument I'd like to make is that the two aren't separable. You can't eliminate the elements of autism that are disabling and preserve the strengths. It doesn't work like that. And if you talk to individuals on the autism spectrum, they will tell you that what makes their life difficult in certain circumstances makes them excel in others. And we heard from Christopher this morning about some very talented individuals who, you know, we believe are on the autism spectrum. We also know some very famous individuals, people like Temple Grandin and Luke Jackson, as I've mentioned, who are incredibly talented. So this notion of prevention and cure is quite a problematic one viewed in that context. So if you think about Temple Grandin and the difficulties that she faced growing up as an autistic individual, but then she's an individual who has absolutely revolutionised the industry in which she's become a part and changed it forever. And the way in which she was able to do that is completely down to her autism. So separating the disabling elements and the strengths is not possible. So this distinct cognitive style associated with autism can make incredibly important contributions to society. I've given you just a couple of examples, but I could give you more examples of some of the children that we've worked with who, whilst they struggle with social interaction, academically are amongst the most bright and able in their classrooms. So biomarker research, from my point of view, is inevitably bound within the medicalized autism discourse. So it sits closely with the view of autism as a disorder and as something that invokes those notions of prevention and cure and so on. And what that does, again, this is coming from the disability viewpoint and from the autism community viewpoint, is that by emphasising prevention and by emphasising cure, we're actually pathologising what is really, to those individuals, just difference. And that's a dangerous road for us to be on. As Pat mentioned, this notion of elective termination of parental choice and the ethics around that, again, create real strong concerns for the autism community. Now, I have to say at this point, I don't claim to speak for the autism community. But one of the, I think the striking thing about the fact that I'm stood up here and talking to you about this as a non-autistic academic is that it highlights the kind of the power disparity that we have when we talk about autism, that there is such a little, so little voice for members of the autism community. Really, it should be somebody from within that community talking to you about these sorts of issues. And they're not currently represented in this area, so they have no voice when the research agenda is set, and this is a major, major challenge. However biomarker research develops and however it's used over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, the key challenge for me, alongside how it's used, is the extent to which we engage members of the autism community and their families in the decision-making process around where the research goes. Parental voice in particular, I talked about the fact that advocates within the autism community typically are from a very high-functioning minority, but parental voice is also important for children with more complex disabilities who may not be able to speak for themselves. And parental voice in autism controversies has been really key. Things like the refrigerator mother theory, MMR controversies, parents played a key role in debunking those myths. And the other thing I wanted to touch upon that relates to this whole area is about the flow of research resources. So we know from analyses of where the research money goes for autism that the vast majority of it goes towards etiological investigations, including biomarker research. And there's actually very little left for studies whose aim is to improve the quality of life of individuals with autism and their families. And again, that's a key thing that needs to change. If biomarker research is going to be used prognostically and predictively, then we need to have a lot more research funding being pumped into those areas where we can look and see, well, how can we support individuals on the autism spectrum to lead meaningful and fulfilled lives? There needs to be a shift. We need to acknowledge and we need to address the power imbalance in this research process if biomarker research is going to be used in that way. So what are some of the wider tensions, challenges and opportunities then? As an education researcher, whilst I have concerns around some of the things I've heard about biomarker research, it's also quite exciting. There are potential opportunities. One of the things that we've really struggled with in education is how do we organise the education system to best meet the needs of children on the autism spectrum? And if there are ways in which we can use biomarker research to provide earlier, more accurate, reliable diagnosis, and also use it prognostically and predictively, again, with accuracy, then there are huge potentials there for sorting provision for children and young people with autism so that the environment best meets their needs. And one of the examples I want to give you is, in England, the number of parents who take their local education authorities to tribunal because certain types of provision are being imposed on them that they feel are not suitable for their child. Well, there is potential there for biomarker research to actually intervene in that process and much more reliably give us information about the likely trajectory of a child's symptoms, the likely trajectory of their difficulties and strengths, and that will enable us to do a much better job at matching the environment to meet their needs from a much earlier stage in their lives. Quite often the children that we speak to in our research and young people, it's taken, you know, up until their compulsory education is nearly over before they've actually, somebody's actually got it right and worked out what it is that this child needs. And by that point, all the opportunity for learning and for development is lost. So there are opportunities there. Some of the other elements then, some of the other challenges. So this notion of construction of identity. If we view autism from a distinctly medicalized viewpoint, that it's a deficiency within the individual and a disorder, that can change the way in which people's identities form. Baines talks about the idea that individuals feel that they need to distance themselves from the autistic label and pass as normal. So people actually actively rejecting their autism and trying to kind of mimic what they see as normality. We spoke to a number of young people in a paper we published about 5 years ago, where we asked young people about what their autism meant to them. These were children quite often with Asperger's or high functioning autism, to tell us about their understanding of their autism. And we saw what Baines talked about. We saw this idea that they, because they had kind of had the discourse of deficiency and the discourse of abnormality from a very early age when they were spoken to by parents and by teachers and by professionals, they had this desire to become normal, to change who they fundamentally were so that society would accept them. They saw that society wouldn't accept them as they were. Lots of children would talk about being retarded, having mental deficiencies and so on. They've picked this up from hearing professionals and hearing parents and hearing teachers talk. Not necessarily those specific terms, but that kind of negative discourse. A key challenge in the medical view, also in terms of diagnosis, is that the diagnostic criteria aren't 100% reliable and they also aren't 100% valid. So there are false positives and there are false negatives. So one of the opportunities for biomarkers is to improve early identification and early diagnosis, which theoretically should improve possibilities for support for people with autism. But again, it's around how that biomarker research is used. And as I said, there are also key opportunities for education. We struggle in education with trying to get the provision right. We struggle in England, and I'm sure you struggle here in Spain. Know we struggle in the States. Trying to actually get the setting right. And all children with autism share similarities, but they're also very unique. No two children with autism are exactly alike, and that's a key challenge for educators. So there are possibilities for biomarker research to help us shape the environment so that it best suits those children's needs. Even if the above were possible, there is still a tension for me as an educator. Biomarker research, my lay view, is it sounds incredibly deterministic and incredibly kind of reductivist. That may be because it's my lay view. But for me, it's at odds with what we know about the powerful influence that the environment can have in helping young people with autism thrive. There are schools and there are family settings that do an incredible job of supporting people. And one of the key things, I think, alongside the biomarker research, is that we need to know much more about how to support people, not just how to identify them early. Thank you very much.